So what steps should clinicians take if psychopharmacologic treatments and school behavioral strategies are insufficient for managing a child with ADHD? We've all been there. ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, of course, affects millions of children and adolescents worldwide and can significantly impact focus and impulses and engaging with friends. Parents and caregivers really need to understand the different kinds of medications and therapies that are available to help manage ADHD. So in this podcast, Mara and I will explore the various treatment options for ADHD in children and discuss how to navigate the process of selecting more effective treatments for your patients. When we first recorded this podcast, which has been in the can for a while, it was a somewhat different situation. Even just a year and a half ago, that underlines how much medicine changes. So you'll hear in this podcast changes in our voices because we've stripped out and added in things to bring this podcast up to date. And again, that underlines how medicine changes so fast that even knowing something 1 year, you don't necessarily know it 2 years from now. And a really good reason to keep doing continuing education, cycling through different topics so that we don't stay behind. I'm Dr. Josh Vader, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Child Psychiatry Report and co-author of the newly released second edition of the Child Medication Factbook for Psychiatric Practice.
And I'm Mara Guverman, a licensed clinical social worker in Southern California with a private practice and an avid reader of the Carlatt Reports.
So what we're going to do is we're going to talk through our recently published algorithm in the Child Medication Factbook for Psychiatric Practice and give you our go-by of how we approach attention deficit hyperactivity.
So Dr. Vader, where do we begin our discussion?
Well, look, you know, when you get somebody in and you've done presumably a decent assessment for ADHD, we're not going to go through all the nuts and bolts of that now. You start with psychoeducation and behavioral parent training, such as Triple P, Incredible Years, PMT, PCIT for preschool to preteen age children. These are evidence-based approaches for helping parents to help kids to be more able to know what they need to do, when they need to do it, and to do it in a collaborative, non-punitive way. Understanding ADHD as part of who you are. In fact, as you know, we're talking about autism, not as autism spectrum disorder, but as autism or autistic people, neurodiversity. And a lot of people think of ADHD that same way now. It's kind of how you're built, how you're wired. And instead of calling it a disorder, I know we have to for insurance purposes, but instead of thinking about it as there's something wrong with you, let's think about it as this is how you're wired and let's see how we work with it. And these kinds of approaches done right help people understand if you can figure out who you are and how you work, you can function better in the world and you can help your kid function better in the world.
So you're talking about acceptance and compassion for people's individual differences.
Well, that's right. And then, you know, once you've done that, there's a couple other pieces that are really important to consider. If you remember our podcast with Russ Barkley a couple of years ago, he talked about how just having ADHD, you might be a little bit less organized and more likely to suffer from chronic diseases that could, you know, reduce your lifespan. And his recommendation was you should be considering stimulant treatment. And in addition to that, thinking about school collaboration. So helping the school to also appreciate the child or teen as someone who's neurodiverse in their own way and looking at accommodations and interventions, 504 plans and individual educational plans, and the use of teacher rating scales to keep us appraised of how that child's doing at school.
Before we move on to the psychopharmacologic treatments, can you give our practitioners a timeline of how long one can anticipate working on psychoeducation or school collaboration and co-parenting before we start moving into psychopharmacologic treatment?
Wow, that's a great question. I think it depends partly on the severity of symptoms. Mm-hmm. If you have somebody who's struggling but not failing, then I think putting some of these things in place, you know, you give it a couple, 3 months. I think the other challenge, of course, is finding someone who's competent to help you as a family. There's such a, you know, dearth of mental health practitioners who really specialize in this or know it. Where do you find the good nuts and bolts stuff that works or people who are good at it? But knowing about these different kinds of approaches might make it easier for people to seek them out. For instance, Incredible Years, you can go on a website and probably find somebody who's a practitioner. Triple P, PMT, a little bit harder. PCIT, Parent-Child Interactive Therapy, you can probably go on a website for that as well and look for people who are specific. But I'd say 1 to 3 months if it's not urgent. If it's more urgent, I think you're more at a place where you really need to be thinking more soon about things like stimulant medications.
So what steps should clinicians take if psychopharmacologic treatments and school and behavioral strategies are insufficient for managing a child with ADHD? What's the next steps?
We think people should be considering starting with stimulants. And when we talk about those, we're really talking about long-acting methylphenidate, such as methylphenidate ER capsules. They're like 50% immediate release, 50% sustained release, or dexmethylphenidate ER capsules, or just the methylphenidate ER tabs, things like that. Why methylphenidate? Fewer side effects typically with that than with dextroamphetamine products. So we tend to try those first.
Is this also a good time to talk about, when thinking about stimulants, blood pressure, weight, and dietary preferences?
Absolutely. So part of your treatment is going to be monitoring blood pressure and pulse and sleep and appetite, and certainly advising parents about making sure kids have been eating and hydrating during the day, or they may be very cranky later on. If you have some of these contraindications to stimulants and no other comorbidity happening, you might try guanfacine, clonidine, the central alpha agonist, or go to atomoxazine or viloxazine, the kind of SNRI-like medications that are like antidepressant cousins that have been approved for ADHD as well. If you have comorbid depression, you might try bupropion. And if you've got insomnia, tics, PTSD, anxiety, appetite concerns, then you're kind of back to guanfacine and clonidine, the central alpha agonist. And remember, with sleep, don't forget cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia that really picks apart the sleep hygiene ideas, but does it in a way that you can actually operationalize and work on them. Just plain sleep hygiene advice, as we've talked about before in these podcasts, usually people know it and they don't really do it unless you have a much more focused attempt to address it, like with CBTI.
Which also includes discussing with patient and parents about when to turn off electronics and TV before bedtime.
Absolutely. Exercise, all those kinds of things that we want kids doing.
Let's say there are no contraindications and you're trying methylphenidate and it's not working.
Plan B is dextroamphetamine products. There are other things that come up as well, right? So in the middle of a methylphenidate trial, you might get a kid who doesn't, swallow pills. And so you might be looking at a transdermal patch or, some other kind of suspension, like a liquid you can swallow. If you end up with some side effects from the methylphenidate, sometimes if you go from long acting to short acting and you can kind of titrate a little bit more through the day, that might be helpful. But, if you're failing methylphenidate trials, try a long acting amphetamine, dextroamphetamine, like Liz dexamphetamine capsules or dextroamphetamine, amphetamine ER capsules.
What are your thoughts when you've tried the amphetamines and they don't work? And how much time do you give to determine whether they're working or not?
So good question. So for any of the stimulant medications, you kind of know in a few days whether a particular dose is working. And it's helpful if you can be in touch with families kind of on a week by week basis and then be bringing them in relatively frequently every few weeks for blood pressure checks and things like that. That'll help you to titrate, whether it's methylphenidate or dextroamphetamine. But if you've got limited effectiveness from your amphetamine type products, then you might try adding an alpha agonist like guanfacine or clonidine. And that combination is often very, very helpful.
If the clinician notices that there's severe aggression concerns remaining, one can try risperidone or valproate, I guess. Yes?
Yeah. So you really want to titrate the stimulants first, because about 60, maybe 80% of the time, you can handle aggression with ADHD with stimulants. So we don't want to just jump to risperidone or valproate, but those two are the ones with the evidence base for effectiveness. And of course, all the caveats with risperidone are there, right? I mean, we worry a lot about metabolic problems. And so you're checking lipids and hemoglobin A1C and other labs as indicated at baseline, then at 12 weeks, then annually or sooner if indicated. You're checking an abnormal involuntary movement scale at baseline and every 6 months or sooner if you're seeing something happening. And you need to consider getting an EKG at baseline and annually with risperidone or any second generation antipsychotic as well. And valproate is valproate. You know, that has potential for hepatic toxicity, pancreatitis. You got to watch the levels on that too. So you just want to be a little bit persnickety about watching these things if you're going to be using them for aggression. But, you know, rather than casting about for lots of different ideas, try these things first. One stimulant titrated. If that doesn't work, another kind of stimulant titrated. You know, go through a couple trials of those. And then, yes, risperidone or valproate.
I guess most parents would want to know, do patients outgrow these medications? Do you ever discontinue them? And what are the indications for when you should be looking at that?
Right. So in ADHD, you know, a number of people settle down. They're not as impulsive, especially when they hit their late teens and early 20s. We think that may have something to do with myelination of your prefrontal cortex. And they look a lot calmer. And there are plenty of people who set aside their medications, whether it's stimulants or the, you know, atomoxetine-like medicines or the central alphas, and including risperidone and valproate. So kids often settle down in their teens and early 20s, and we love to see that. In fact, for any person on medication, I think it's a fair question of how long do they need to be on it. We see kids who are growing and they seem to grow out of their doses and seem to need a little bit more of all of these medications. So we titrate based on that. But for a kid who's stable for 6 to 12 months, I'm always asking, can we be reducing or discontinuing? Are they doing better? And I think it is appropriate and ethically important to be having these ongoing discussions. Relatively few people want to be on medicine. However, if as you're going down and go down relatively slowly, you don't just stop the medicine, but titrate down maybe by at most 25% over a couple months and then another 25%. If you're seeing deterioration, well, usually you go back up and you hold it steady and then maybe try again another year later. What I've found is that lots of times over the years, you have people who can come off and people who don't. That's just how that unfolds.
Do you have any words of wisdom for clinicians who have clients who are going off to college that are taking stimulants?
Well, so, I mean, that's something we need to start thinking about years before anybody goes away, right? You need to be able to do laundry, find food, get yourself to sleep, knowing how to take your own medications, and how do you get them from the pharmacy? We actually had a piece on that in the Carlisle Child Psychiatry Report a little while back that people can reference that goes into it in some depth. But if you don't know how to take your medicine, you know, you may have a lot more trouble organizing yourself, getting your work done, and really making it in college. You know, think about this. To be out there on your own and not taking care of yourself, which includes not taking the medicine that you need to help you take care of yourself, what a difficult conundrum to be in, right?
Yes, and as a practitioner, we think about that executive function piece and being able to balance all of the stimulation that comes along with a freshman, which is sleep, socializing, organizing classes, getting there. There's so much that goes into a successful year, and those are things that a therapist would benefit talking to their clients about.
Stimulants, have street value. Mm-hmm. And if nothing else, get a lockbox and you get a cable for it and you tie the thing to your bed frame, or you lock it to your bed frame and put your wallet and your keys and your stimulant medications in there. And you don't make a big deal of having them so that you don't have people breaking in and taking your medication, because replacing it may be difficult. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing is just the decision making, right? Are you going to go out with your friends? Are you going to use substances? Mm-hmm. All those things, people can make better decisions when they're sticking with their ADHD medication.
And have a plan, discussing what's your plan, what's the limits of boundaries, so that there's an awareness instead of being overwhelmed or surprised in many situations that are new. As a psychiatrist, what's the bottom line that's most important to you on this topic?
My biggest decision point is whether somebody can be away at college and be okay. Meaning they can come back and see me every 3 to 6 months and I can refill their medicine. And state laws are going to vary about what you are and aren't allowed to do in terms of being a doctor and treating someone from far away. But for the most part, I think most people are covered. If the kid is domiciled at home but is away for college, nobody makes a big deal about it. But if the kid's not stable enough for that, that's when you get into trouble. So think about this for planning. You need to think about whether somebody needs a psychiatrist or other prescriber at school or near school, a therapist at school or near school, and you've got to plan for that and get it set up. Well, that's not easy to do for a whole lot of reasons. The first is that there's shortages of mental health providers in the first place. The second is that a lot of people aren't going to want to establish a relationship before you're actually in town. And then the other piece is there are some people who seem like they're ready, but then they get to school and the wheels fall off. Mm-hmm. So then you're scrambling around looking for care, or you're deciding, do we have to bring this person back for a day, a week, a month, a semester, you know, forget the whole thing and stay at home. And you think about the, you know, how sad that can feel, feeling like, you know, kind of a failure sometimes. So there's a lot to consider. And I'd say the biggest inflection point, if you will, is getting it right about whether you need help at school. And if you're going to need help at school, are you ready to go away? That's another question. On the other hand, if you don't give it a try, are you ever going to launch? So there's so much, you know, at stake a lot of times. In most American culture, a lot of it anyway, the goal is to grow up, learn something that you can do, get a job and go take care of yourself, you know, pay your own bills and find your own place and maybe have a relationship and start your own family. But the idea is that you're going to be independent of your family of origin, right? That's not true in a lot of ways, right? One is that a huge percentage of post-college age kids are back living at home, which is very similar to a lot of cultures. I think of Panama and other countries where kids live at home until they get married. It's also different from a lot of subcultures. And you can't just presume that the family that somebody is in is aiming to have a kid out and independent. I think financially, that's often a goal for some people, but not necessarily. There are a lot of families for whom the goal isn't independence. It's what can this person do to help the family? And maybe, you know, getting a career will help the family. It's not that they're going to be independent and self-actualized. It's that the family is going to be supported as a unit. And so you got to be careful not to make judgments based on perhaps your own family of origin or values that you've grown up with.
As a prescribing doctor with boots on the ground, what is it like for you and your clients in light of the medication shortages that are being reported?
Well, they're not just reported. I mean, we are living this every day. Mm. Okay, so a few years ago, you would write a script on a triplicate by hand. And at least if one pharmacy didn't have the stuff, they could go to another pharmacy. But shortages weren't that big a deal 5-6 years ago. Now that most of us are required to do electronic prescriptions, at least for my platform, you put the thing in, you use your extra verification because it's a controlled substance, And then you find out a few days later that the pharmacy doesn't have what it is. And it could be something as simple as generics. So dextroamphetamine salts extended release, aka Adderall XR, right? It could be something fancy like Vyvanse or Jornay. It used to be that the fancier stuff that was more expensive would be maybe in better supply because people didn't want to pay for it. Now that stuff, people kind of all pivot to, you know, maybe Vyvanse, and then that's all gone. And then you're pivoting back to Adderall XR or pivoting from dextroamphetamine to methylphenidate and back again, just because you're searching for some stimulant for somebody who's responded well to it. And lots of times after figuring out which kind of packaging they respond to, because not everybody responds as well to one stimulant or another, or one kind of packaging or another. And then, at least for me, I have to change the default for all their prescriptions in my platform every time we discover something we want to try for them at yet another pharmacy. And then who's going to make all those calls to the pharmacy, right? So sometimes patients will do it, but a lot of times the pharmacies won't tell a patient what they have. They want the doctor to call. Well, I'm going to call five pharmacies. Sometimes you call a chain and they'll tell you if there's some of it somewhere in the county. Sometimes they won't. And sometimes they'll tell you that maybe they have something somewhere. You call that place to be sure and they don't have it. Mm. Or patient calls and says, they have what I need. They told me they have what I need at, you know, whatever pharmacy, you know. But, you know, I'm with patients right now and I get that message 2 hours later. Are they still going to have it? Mm-hmm. I don't know. So it's basically everybody running around scurrying to try to get these medications that are now in such short supply, especially since the pandemic, which seems to have done a couple things. One is it's made more clear that it's hard to focus when you're online. And maybe that's ADHD sometimes, or, you know, exacerbated by the online environment. Or maybe it's one of the impacts of the COVID infection itself, which we think is one of the things that happens, almost like a mild encephalitic response that gives you ADHD symptoms, which are responsive to stimulants. So for lots of different reasons, we have more people perhaps appropriately benefiting from stimulants, more people who believe they have ADHD wanting stimulants. And then we've got the manufacturers who haven't been given the right to make more of what they could make. And my understanding is that some of them are not even producing the limit of what they could make to sell. So here we've got this major shortage and we're all scurrying about, and it's a real pain in the neck.
So there you have it. When choosing a stimulant, the first decision is between an amphetamine or methylphenidate preparation. More recent data have suggested that, based on safety and efficacy, methylphenidates are a better choice for kids and adolescents, whereas amphetamine class agents are better in adults. Yet, even in adults, we generally recommend going with the methylphenidate preparation first, based on lower side effect and misuse potential.
The second decision is choosing between a long-acting or short-acting stimulant. For kids who don't like swallowing pills, there are various options. Some long-acting stimulants can be opened or sprinkled on food. There are also short- and long-acting liquid, chewable, and disintegrating brand-name options, though they are expensive and often require pre-authorization.
Finally, another option for the pill phobics is the Daytrana or Zellstrom patch. When initiating a trial of stimulant medication, titrating the dose on a weekly basis optimizes the response efficiently, with the added benefit of limiting the use of additional medications with their associated side effects. While valproate and risperidone have been demonstrated to be effective for aggression with ADHD, you will rarely need them if you prioritize stimulant titration.
ADHD is under-recognized, probably more than it's over-diagnosed, and therefore under-treated more than it's over-treated. The treatment starts with structuring your life in a way that makes things work better, putting your keys in the same place or, you know, everything else so that you know where it is. But medication truly makes a difference in being able to take care of yourself. When there's side effects, we can usually figure out ways to manage them as well. And if you can't do that as an adult, whether you're a young adult or, you know, older, and you need somebody to help you, it's okay to have somebody helping you do that so that everybody functions better. We're not meant to live isolated lives. We're meant to live interdependently. So, you know, learn to surf your ADHD along with other people, just like I hope you'll accept other people in there bothering you about the things you need to do, like remember your medication and appreciate them for it rather than give them a hard time about it. And everybody will be happier and more functional. We can enjoy each other, including our differences. The algorithm is available for people to read in the CARLAP Medication Factbook for Psychiatric Practice, second edition, available now. Hopefully you'll get a copy of it and check out all our algorithms. For those of you who are CARLAP Child Psychiatry Report subscribers, you'll get print issues in the mail and email notifications when new issues are available on the website. Subscriptions also come with full access to all the articles on the website and CME credits, which supports the algorithms that we talked about today.
And everything from CARLAP Publishing is independently researched and produced. There's no funding from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, the newsletters and books we produce depend entirely on reader support. There are no ads, and our authors don't receive industry funding. That helps us to bring you unbiased information that you can trust.
Thanks for listening, and have a great day.